It's Diane. On my mind, our country's botched response to monkeypox.
Monkeypox was a trial run to show what we've learned from the coronavirus outbreak and whether we're ready to contain the next virus. And the answer, unfortunately, is not really.
Dan Diamond is a national health reporter at the Washington Post. He joined me to explain the scope of the monkeypox outbreak, just how dangerous the virus is, and why the U.S. failed to contain it. Dan, when we first heard about COVID, they talked about open meat markets in China. Where is the monkeypox coming from? What do we know?
The early spread of monkeypox, which is a virus that transmits by close contact, sexual contact, seems to have emerged from some dance parties, some raves in Europe earlier this spring, with many gay men traveling from around the world to go to these parties. So that was an inciting incident. The men danced, touched closely, maybe in the nude, had sex, and then went back to their home countries. Monkeypox can incubate for a few weeks, so the cases weren't detected right away. But those were signal moments that led to the spread of this virus over the past few months.
Well, why is it called monkeypox?
So monkeypox first emerged decades ago, and it was found in lab monkeys in the 1950s. But the name of the virus is somewhat misleading. It really has very little to do with monkeypox. It's mostly spread by rodents in West and Central Africa. It's then shown up in people, too. It can spread by close contact, also potentially by touching something that a person with monkeypox has handled, like a towel. If I use the same towel that a person who has lesions from monkeypox used to get out of the shower and I use that towel again, that may be a way for the virus to transmit to. It seems that the current outbreak, which has now spread to more than 45,000 people around the world, 16,000 plus people in the United States. I talked to Trevor Bedford, a scientist who has been chronicling COVID, now tracking monkeypox. He puts this outbreak back in Nigeria 5 or 6 years ago, that this was when it was really spreading person to person, mostly in men, some women, some kids. But there's a genetic commonality with the virus that was spreading in Nigeria a few years ago and the one that is now spreading around the world. The role of COVID is interesting here, in that maybe this monkeypox outbreak would have taken off in 2020, in 2021, but because travel was so shut down, because the world was so shut down, it has only exploded in these recent months. And Diane, I think the calendar was not our friend too. There were gay men who had been cooped up like the rest of us for a few years. They were vaccinated. They wanted to get together for Pride Month, especially in June. But those Pride Month parties, dancing together, having casual sex, it became the perfect transmission point to accelerate the virus even further across the U.S. and the world.
Dan, tell me how serious monkeypox really is.
Diane, when you and I first spoke about the coronavirus in early March 2020, there was real fear about the pain and panic that was looming with that pandemic. This is not the coronavirus. There are no confirmed deaths in the United States as we speak. Monkeypox is overwhelmingly striking adult gay men who are picking it up through sexual behaviors, not because it's hanging in the air in a classroom or because a home health aide is giving it to someone else. And unlike COVID, this is not a new virus. It's been around for decades. We have vaccines and treatments that work to contain it. But I would say the past few months have been pretty disappointing. Monkeypox was a trial run to show what we've learned from the coronavirus outbreak and whether we're ready to contain the next virus. And the answer, unfortunately, is not really.
Didn't I understand a news report about a child who had contracted monkeypox?
There have been more than a dozen children in the United States who have contracted monkeypox. It's thought that this is from household transmission. So maybe one of your parents has this virus, which can cause severe pain. It can cause real problems. There are long-lasting complications in some cases for monkeypox, people who have scarring, who have damage to their immune system. So far, the cases in kids, as far as I know, have not led to serious problems. But again, if you're looking at that total population, overwhelmingly, more than 95% of cases are in gay men, bisexual men, and not in kids or the elderly. There was an incident recently where a daycare worker in Illinois tested positive for monkeypox. And I spoke to the health officials on the ground in Illinois who were rushing to contain this outbreak. There were dozens of people, overwhelmingly kids, exposed at the daycare. This worker also worked as a home health aide to an older person. But of the 60 people or so who were potentially exposed, at this point, several weeks later, none have developed monkeypox. Now, that may be because they rushed vaccines to everyone who was exposed and that was able to contain the virus. But it also suggests to me, Diane, this is not COVID. In a world where a daycare worker 2 years ago is walking around with COVID, you would expect many infections. In this case, we seem to have gotten none.
All right, but how serious is it? How painful is it? What are the long-term effects? You know, I mean, this sounds like another rendition of AIDS.
It's similar to AIDS and HIV in a couple ways. First, that it is showing up initially in the gay community.
Right.
And in some ways being dismissed because of that. But it shouldn't be. It can spill into other populations. And I think that is one of the big fears and a driving point of our coverage at the Washington Post, that monkeypox could become permanent in the United States. It's never been permanent here before. The biggest past outbreak was a couple dozen people about 20 years ago. The fact that it's now infected 16,000 plus suggests that maybe it will take root and become endemic, become permanently entrenched in the United States and infect a lot of people in outbreaks to come. You're right also that like HIV and AIDS, it's poorly understood right now. And that has led to myths that have affected the gay community, some harassment. A few blocks from where I live in Washington, D.C., two gay men were harassed and beaten up on the street for being accused of being monkeypox carriers. Unlike HIV and AIDS, and COVID certainly, monkeypox or the current strain is rarely fatal, but it can still cause severe pain in people. I was looking at CDC data the past few days, and this is particularly when the monkeypox lesions show up in sensitive places, maybe transmitted by sex. Nearly half of the people surveyed by CDC said they had rectal pain. 1 in 4 said they had rectal bleeding. And I've talked to patients who say it feels like there's broken glass inside of them. They can't sit, they can't sleep, they can't use the bathroom for days and days. And the rash and lesions from monkeypox can lead to scarring and severe tissue damage. I saw some photos last week in a medical journal of a patient whose monkeypox infection and some other conditions combined to lead to the person's nose rotting, literally turning black. So that person will suffer for the rest of his life because of this monkeypox infection.
Wow. So how does it first show up?
Usually it appears as a rash, maybe a lesion that folks think is a mosquito bite. And then over the course of some days, it can progress to more serious symptoms, fever, headache, swollen lymph nodes that may extend a few inches. This outbreak has been somewhat different than past monkeypox outbreaks because so many of the cases are linked back to sexual behavior. So gay men have been finding these lesions in really sensitive places, their penis, their anus, sometimes inside their body. And that has led to misdiagnoses, especially at the beginning, where doctors said, you don't have monkeypox, you have some other sexually transmitted disease.
That's what I was going to ask. How educated have doctors been about monkeypox, or are they in the process of being educated?
That's a great question. If we had spoken in June or July, I would say not particularly educated. I was talking to patients regularly who were trying to get treatment, trying to get vaccines. And again, we do have these resources. It's not like early COVID. You should be able to walk in with your monkeypox case and get a treatment known as TPOX. But I spoke to patients who said, doctors told them, health aides told them, there's no treatment for this. You should just take some antibiotic, or you should take Tylenol, which is just not true. It has improved considerably in recent weeks. I think the fact that the United States declared in early August a public health emergency raised awareness of monkeypox. The CDC has tried to hold trainings and briefings for doctors and also tried to make it easier to access these treatments and vaccines.
Can you get these treatments, say, at your local CVS?
Not yet, and that's been part of the problem. If you rewind to the beginning of this monkeypox outbreak, the initial testing had to be done through state public health laboratories. You couldn't go down to your local pharmacy. You couldn't go to your local Quest Diagnostics or LabCorp. It was a very tightly controlled system, which has echoes of what happened in early COVID. People couldn't get tested at their local providers even if they wanted to. Similarly, if you wanted to get this TPOXX treatment, the doctor had to go through reams and reams of paperwork, hours and hours. I spoke to one doctor in New York City, Diane, I think this was in July, who said he could only process the paperwork for two patients a day at best to get TPOXX. He was essentially setting up an individual clinical trial for each one. There was a good reason for this. Up until 2022, we hadn't seen massive monkeypox outbreaks. There might be one patient, two patients a year. So in those cases, federal officials said, hey, we want to understand where this patient came from, what the treatment is doing. So that's why there had been so much bureaucracy. But when the system got flooded like this, the federal government and its tight controls over treatment and testing weren't set up to accommodate it.
So what is TPOXX and just how effective is it?
TPOXX is a treatment that was approved by the FDA for the related virus of smallpox a few years ago, but it has been allowed to be used for monkeypox, which is less severe than smallpox. And that's, again, part of the reason for the paperwork, that to use it for monkeypox, you've had to go through these extra steps as a physician. It has proved to be, anecdotally, pretty effective. I've talked to patients who say they had horrible pain and lesions. They took TPOXX, and within a few days, the lesions scabbed up, the pain passed. So it has been a real cure for lots and lots of people infected with monkeypox. The challenge is very few people infected with monkeypox proportionally have gotten TPOXX. I believe at the last count, it was somewhere in the low thousands, as opposed to, you know, the total population of 16,000. The federal government says it is moving to make TPOXX even more accessible in upcoming weeks, that it will be positioning it in sites around the country for more ready use of the drug in the coming days.
What's the normal duration of monkeypox symptoms?
It can vary, and the virus itself can vary in how quickly it shows up. I spoke to one physician at Mass General who characterized it as just a really difficult outbreak to fight, because in some cases, people are developing symptoms within days. In other cases, they're developing symptoms only after a few weeks of incubation. So you can go to that party in Washington, D.C. and get monkeypox, and then go travel the country for a few weeks and maybe have casual sex a few times, and then it turns out you've had monkeypox. So there are very different courses. I would say that in many cases, I've spoken to patients who have had symptoms that last a week, longer than a week, where it progresses from slight discomfort to severe pain. Other patients who have gotten TPOXX, that's been condensed down to a few days. But I don't think we know yet how the average monkeypox patient is dealing with symptoms and how they manifest, just because we're still relatively early in the outbreak and the data that we're getting is incomplete. There have not been broad studies yet, especially of some of the people who've been turned away and not been captured well by the system.
Dan, what kind of vaccine is available?
There is one vaccine approved for monkeypox called Jynneos, and the United States has had limited supply of Jynneos, so much so that federal officials recently said they were going to start cutting the doses up into fifths to try and stretch the supply that we had. we have a second vaccine called ACAM2000. It is approved for smallpox, not monkeypox, but it is thought to offer similar protection for monkeypox. But Diane, it is a riskier vaccine. It has more side effects. There's a chance that if you're injected with ACAM2000 and it's not properly done, the site is not properly cared for, it can actually lead to more low-level infections. In this world that we're living in of people not having confidence in COVID vaccines, flu vaccines, federal officials I've spoken to said, we don't want to use this fallback ACAM2000 unless we absolutely have to. So the focus has been on getting more of the JYNNEOS vaccine and stretching the supply that we have. Unclear, though, whether the plan to stretch the supply is working out as well as federal officials want it to.
But don't I understand that we actually owned millions of doses of that vaccine? What happened to them?
It's a great question. So entering this monkeypox outbreak, the United States had in its emergency stockpile, a stockpile that's gotten a lot of attention these past few years because of COVID, so this stockpile of masks and treatments and vaccines, we had copious doses of ACAM2000, this older vaccine for smallpox. But we only had physically present in the United States about 2,500 doses of JYNNEOS, the monkeypox vaccine. There were a bunch of reasons for this. I spoke to the official who oversees the stockpile. She said we had no real reason to stock up on monkeypox. That wasn't one of our target threats in early 2022, unlike, say, smallpox. And we did have all of these doses overseas at the factory where they were produced in Denmark, either sitting on the shelf, completed, or waiting in raw material, millions and millions of more doses. The reason those weren't brought over here is twofold. First, the federal government in the United States doesn't have, if you can believe this, we don't have the same kind of freezers that are in Denmark. As the health official Don O'Connell told me, the temperature in Denmark of these freezers is negative 50 degrees. Here in the United States, it's negative 20 degrees. So once you take the vaccines from that colder freezer and put it in our freezer in the States, you start losing more shelf life quickly, as opposed to keeping it in the colder setting. And then we had millions of doses that we owned in raw material, so vaccines that hadn't been made yet. The comparison I might use is think about baking a cake. You've got the flour, you've got the supplies sitting in your cupboard. Once you start making them into a cake, the cake will go stale within a few weeks, but you can keep that flour for much, much longer. And that's the situation we had there, where officials said, well, we're not sure we want to turn these into vaccines yet. We don't know how much demand there will actually be. And it turns out we underestimated how much demand there would be.
So how rapid has the putting together of these ingredients actually been to create the vaccine that we want and need?
It is now underway. The manufacturer of the vaccine, Bavarian Nordic, the small Danish company, is partnering with a U.S. manufacturer, may also end up partnering with a U.S. pharmaceutical company. I've heard that the federal government is talking to companies like Pfizer and Merck to accelerate production of this future vaccine, especially because if we're in this world where monkeypox becomes permanently entrenched in the United States, we may need to vaccinate many, many people to protect them. There are monkeypox outbreaks around the world too, so lots of people are clamoring for this JYNNEOS vaccine that until recently was pretty limited. But the new vaccine supplies are probably not going to come online until the end of 2022, maybe early 2023. So as a result, the current supply is getting stretched through the strategy of splitting up the doses and injecting them somewhat differently in hopes of getting us through what I've called a vaccine cliff, where the supply has really dropped off for a few months and we need to figure out how to get from this current moment to the moment when more vaccine will arrive.
So how effective have these lower doses been?
We're still finding that out. The federal government made its decision based on a seven-year-old study, a study from the year 2015 of a couple hundred people who got the vaccine split up into fifths and then had it injected what's known as intradermally. So it's a different angle. When the vaccine goes in, there's a little bubble that appears on your skin to suggest that the vaccine has been delivered. There might be a rash for days or weeks actually after. It's different than, say, getting the COVID vaccine, where it's this more normal subcutaneous injection in your, say, shoulder. There are some patients who say that they've gotten this new administration and they are confused why there's a rash that lingers for days or weeks. So there's some fear that maybe people will see that and not want to come back for their second shot. It's supposed to be a two-dose vaccine. There's also some concern that people administering the shots need extra training and may not be doing it quite the right way. So that may not show up right away. And then there's a third challenge in that the U.S. government said, okay, we will split these vials into five doses. You can now, rather than use all the vaccine in this vial for one person, try and make it stretch for five. But the folks on the front line are saying, well, we actually can't get five doses out of this one vial. Maybe we can get three. Maybe we can get four. Or maybe we only can get one or two, and then we have to throw the vial away because other people didn't show up in time for us to use it. So it's been a little bumpy on the front lines. We won't know, I think, for some weeks or months how much protection these folks are getting until we see monkeypox cases, how they're showing up in these vaccinated people, whether there are breakthrough infections. So the jury is out somewhat on the long-term effectiveness here.
Of course, the other question is, what about the shelf life of the ingredients themselves, which have been sitting overseas for all these years, not made into a vaccine?
That's a good question. So the ingredients that haven't been made into a vaccine, those are still viable. And the HHS official pointed out, once we start making them into a vaccine, then the clock starts ticking faster. We've got still, though, years to use the vaccines that are made from the raw materials. The vaccine maker is also evaluating old doses that we had that reached their shelf life. Imagine the milk in your refrigerator says used by August 15th, and now it's August 30th, and you're not sure whether to use it. So the vaccine maker is looking at these doses that nominally expired, but trying to figure out whether we can use some of the older doses to fill the need we have now.
You know, right now, we're saying that nobody has died from this monkeypox. Are you concerned that this could affect people in ways we do not now understand?
It's an interesting question. I'm not a virologist, so I don't want to speculate too much. I think it's fair to say that with any new outbreak, the long-term consequences bear considerable study. The folks who said in early 2020, just get COVID infections and get them over with, in retrospect, some of those folks may have regretted that. The symptoms can linger. There were folks who have long COVID. It's usually better to try and get as much protection as possible and minimize whatever symptoms may come. We do know with monkeypox that there are people who get brain inflammation, sepsis, so infections in the blood, long-term complications that will really linger. And I have spoken to patients who had monkeypox weeks ago and are still not feeling fully healthy. Whether this will lead to some major problems in the years to come, I just don't know. With monkeypox, it does seem to resolve pretty well in most people. But it's, again, it's a new outbreak, and we have to wait and see what the data tells us.
A quick break. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Dan Diamond, national health reporter at the Washington Post. Dan, how effective has the CDC been throughout this whole outbreak?
So today we have more than 16,000 cases in the United States, about 100 days after the first case. I think if you'd asked anyone to predict this outbreak, Diane, back in May, the numbers we're seeing right now would have been perceived as a major failure. And some of that is on CDC. CDC played a major role in how the testing was limited at the beginning. It's very hard to spot clusters of infections, to spot outbreaks, if people can't get tested. And part of the reason they couldn't get tested was how the CDC pushed to limit who was getting tested early on, whether that was out of fear of people who were worried but not actually having monkeypox rushing the system, whether it was because they were trying to control the data flow. Either way, I know there was a lot of regret in the federal government that more testing wasn't done earlier. Some of that rests on CDC. The issue of where vaccines went around the country in the early days. The CDC came up with a formula about where the vaccines should go. It was weighted more toward where the populations of gay men were, where HIV-positive people were, and not as weighted toward where the number of cases were. So New York City has been the epicenter of the United States outbreak, more cases there than anywhere else. Mayor Eric Adams got very upset that his city wasn't getting more vaccines, that they were going to places where there were not as many cases. So you could argue the CDC could have rushed more vaccines to the places with greatest need, like New York City earlier. So I think that rests somewhat on CDC. And then there's a question about risk communication. This virus has been spreading in the gay community. It spread a lot during Pride Month. There could have been more aggressive warnings to that community saying, if you're going to Pride parties, if you're dancing naked at these parties, which happens quite a bit, if you're having casual sex, you need to know of your elevated risk for monkeypox.
And why wasn't that message sent?
That message came through piecemeal, nationally and locally, but I think some of it was, Diane, fear of stigma, fear of making gay people feel like they were being wrongly singled out, fear of turning broad populations on the gay community. I think it came from a good place, but the reality was there were many gay men who didn't understand their specific risk, and had there been louder, more aggressive, and more targeted warnings, perhaps some of them, if not many of them, could have avoided monkeypox these past number of weeks.
So we've got the Biden administration trying to do whatever it can now. But how effective has the administration been, both in speeding up the production of the vaccine and in getting the message out?
If I can plug the work of the Washington Post, my colleagues Fenton Irapal, Lena Sun, and I wrote a long story this month on essentially the first 100 days of monkeypox, what went right and, unfortunately, what often went wrong from the federal level to the local level. I think there were stumbles, some of which we've talked about, with the distribution of vaccines, with the limited testing, the communications early on. Some of that did rest on this White House, on the Biden administration. President Biden had campaigned pretty aggressively on being a president who knew how to fight pandemics. And one of his first actions in office, I think this was January 20th or 21st of 2021, was to establish a White House pandemic team. This team had been disbanded under President Trump. President Biden said, this is what we need as kind of our tip of the spear. And that pandemic team, in retrospect, struggled to lead the response across May and June. It has since been minimized in its role fighting monkeypox. There's been a new White House pandemic team established in August. I think we are seeing some positive trends, Diane. I was looking right before we got on this interview, and there is a flattening out of new case trends. Still seeing hundreds and hundreds of new cases every day, but it's not growing exponentially the way monkeypox was growing across July and into early August. So there's some indication that whether it's gay men changing their behavior, whether it's people getting vaccinated, the messages being clearer, we may be getting control of this outbreak. But I don't know if it's too late for the outbreak to become embedded in the United States. That is, I think, the big fear, not not to set aside the pain that people are feeling now, but we don't want to have to fight monkeypox and flare-ups of it every few months or years for the rest of our lives. The hope would be that we could really eradicate it, and it's unclear to me whether the Biden administration moved aggressively enough to be in position to eradicate it.
However, the Biden administration has now said we are at a turning point with the monkeypox virus. What is meant by that, and what do you interpret by that?
There were a couple things that happened in quick succession in early August. I may be getting the order slightly wrong on this, so forgive me, but I think the first thing that happened was the White House said, we are naming a coordinator for the monkeypox virus. Your listeners may recall, we named a coordinator for Ebola almost 10 years ago. That was Ron Klain in the Obama administration, brought in a coordinator to run the Ebola response. The Trump administration brought in Deborah Birx to be the coordinator for the COVID response. So the White House will do this, create a coordinator job, and that's a strategy that they've now taken, built up this new White House team this month that's leading the monkeypox response. So that's one turning point. I think a second turning point is the decision to declare a public health emergency. A lot of that was symbolic. It doesn't change anything about monkeypox on Wednesday to Thursday. It's exactly the same virus. But it allows for some new flexibility in how the federal government can make resources available, potentially get more funding. So that was a signal point. And then a third decision was the strategy to split up the vaccine doses, which took what had been a limited supply, a fear of a vaccine cliff approaching, and then allowed the United States government to say, we will be able to cover the 1.5 million people we think are highest risk. Up until that point, there wasn't enough vaccine to cover more than about a third of them. So all of those things happened really quickly and around the same time in early August. There has been a different focus, I think, from the federal government that I've seen covering this in the past couple weeks. But all of those decisions have faced some questions. For instance, splitting up the vaccine doses, and this was something we reported first at the Post, the vaccine manufacturer didn't realize that the United States government was going to announce that plan and had some private safety concerns and even threatened that if the U.S. went forward with splitting up the doses, the U.S. will lose all future vaccine orders. That was a big deal. So these changes happened quickly, but at a rate that surprised some people and may have created further stumbles in our monkeypox response.
What about people of color and Hispanic populations? Are they being hit harder with this monkeypox than the rest of the population?
That's such an important question, and one that we've tried to look at here at the Post. My colleague Fenton Irapal has written several stories about how the virus is spreading in the gay community and whether folks with privileges are getting more, if not disproportionately getting the virus, getting more protection against the virus. When vaccines first became available, when the appointments first started being posted in late June, I believe, the people who rushed to sign up online for these appointments were overwhelmingly white, well-connected. People who have health insurance have been able to better navigate the system and get treatments like TPOXX. Fennett has chronicled in his stories the Hispanic men, the black men who have been turned away by the system and in some cases suffered for days not getting treatment or help because, as we've seen with every health crisis, people with access and wealth get to the front of the line and people who don't have those privileges get shunted to the sides. That, I know, has been a growing focus of how this White House team is trying to attack disparities in monkeypox.
You've said that monkeypox is likely to take hold in this country. If it does, I mean, if you get on a plane and you pull down the tray in front of you and someone with monkeypox who perhaps has not shown yet the outbreak on the skin, but is using that tray, touching that tray. I mean, is that how it could spread? We were supposed to have completely eradicated measles, smallpox, and look what's happening. It's all coming back again.
I would first say I don't know if it's likely that monkeypox will become permanent. It's certainly highly possible, and I've spoken to experts like Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner who's been a major figure in the COVID fight. He believes the barn door has been open for too long and it might be too late to close it on monkeypox. So there's significant fear that it's too late. I don't know if we can say for sure if it's likely or not likely, but certainly 16,000 cases in the United States makes it a lot more likely than if we'd been able to contain this with just a few dozen people a few months ago, that monkeypox becomes endemic. What you're asking about is what I think is known as first asymptomatic spread. So just like with COVID, if people aren't showing symptoms, if they don't have the lesions, if they don't have the fever, can they transmit monkeypox by touching towels and touching other items that people get in contact with? I think the early evidence so far is pretty resoundingly no. This daycare example in Illinois, to me, was a signal event where you had so many different people potentially exposed by this worker. And the fact that none of these kids or adults, as far as we can tell, has tested positive yet, that to me suggests that monkeypox is much harder to spread than the fear of it might imply. Because so many of the cases have been through sex, where there's significant physical touching, where there might be, this is still being studied, but it may be contained in semen, which may be accelerating the amount of viral spread is possible. That's very different than handling an airplane tray. You bring up a great point, though, about the risk of these diseases that we thought had been eradicated surging back. Why does it seem like there are so many right now? I have talked with Anthony Fauci about this, the infectious disease expert. One of his theories and fears is we've seen a loss of vaccination against some common conditions. We've seen human beings brush up against the animal environment in increasing ways, whether it's the tear down of rainforests. We've lost some surveillance in some places around animal to human transmission. So it's unfortunate to see whether monkeypox resurgent or polio resurgent, these viruses that we thought we had licked coming back and posing threats to the general population.
One last question, and maybe it's too early to answer. What do you think the lessons are thus far that we can draw from monkeypox?
I don't think it's too early at all. 100 days of monkeypox is a good point to reflect. First, we remain woefully underprepared for the next virus. After 2 years of hearing that we couldn't let COVID happen again, we got monkeypox, which is like an easy COVID. It's a virus we know. We have tests for it. We have treatment for it. It spreads not as quickly. It doesn't cause as severe symptoms. And yet, we have 16,000 cases when we could have had many, many fewer with a more aggressive response. So one lesson to me, Diane, is that for the next virus, which could be a lot worse than monkeypox and could be worse than COVID, there probably needs to be a much more aggressive response mounted more quickly. That means more rapid access to testing, taking more chances on spending on, say, vaccines, so we're not put in a position where we're waiting for these vaccines to be shipped over from another country. It says to me that we need to be pretty explicit with our communications and not worry about offending people. The gay community, I think, in retrospect, would have liked really direct communication rather than having to understand now why this virus spread so quickly. And I think there's a broader question about how we fund and pay for pandemics. Democrats have been fighting for more COVID funding. that funding has been stalled for months because of that freeze on Capitol Hill, largely due to Republicans, though not entirely. The White House has been cautious about asking for more monkeypox money. In a world where that COVID money hadn't been stalled, there hadn't been so much fighting over it, the White House might have been more aggressive in asking for funding to do things on monkeypox. So we're in an environment where it's become harder to fight viruses and pandemics than you might think after COVID, I think because there's been so much second guessing about COVID, and it may have led to the wrong lessons being taken away.
Dan Diamond, thank you so much for being with us. And kudos to the Washington Post and you and your colleagues for the work you've done on this virus.
Diane, it is such a privilege to be with you. Thank you on behalf of my colleagues for those kind words. I need to write something that is happy so I can come back and talk to you, not about a pandemic, but about like a movie or something at some future point.
Someday.
Here's hoping. Thank you so much.
That was Dan Diamond, National Health Reporter at the Washington Post. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Kellen Quigley. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.